Hey, happy Saturday here in Culver City, smoky Culver City. our hearts and thoughts go out to Thousand Oaks, the TO, and people in paradise and suffering from the fires. So prayers and thoughts are with you. But that sexy voice you just heard right now, I want to introduce Dr. Kimai Wilson, who is a gift to this university, and to this universe. Please tell me a little bit about you. Tell me your name, what you do, and how wonderful you are.
Oh, first and foremost, Anne-Marie, I think I have to, I must say how excited I am to talk with you. I've listened to the podcast, and you've had some amazing people on, so I don't know why you invited me.
Oh, please. Oh, my gosh.
But I love the work you're doing.
Thank you.
It's definitely needed in our society. We need to hear great voices. Strong voices, powerful voices, and you represent that. So I thank you sincerely for inviting me today.
I get goofy around you. I don't know what it is. I get around him, I get all goofy and weak-kneed, and I'm on the wrong team. I don't know why I get so goofy and weak-kneed around this guy. But no, if you saw him, you'd understand. But anyway, I digress. Back to your essence and not your physical package.
Yes.
I do not want... Anyway, so Dr. Kimai Wilson. Kimai, yes. Tell me a little bit about your... Let's start with your name.
Oh, so my name... Right, my name was given to my mother from my godmother, and it's Swahili.
Okay.
It means great African warrior.
Perfect.
And so I think as I get older now, I'm finding out how I'm really walking into my name, and I think it really defines where I think, also walking into my purpose. So okay. I love my name. It's funny. Most of my friends and some of my family get upset when people mispronounce my name, obviously, but I'm just like, give folks a break. Hey, it's their first time seeing it, right? And it's unusual, it's different, and so give people a pass. And so, but I love my name.
And you spell it how?
K-I-M-I.
Yes.
But if you talk to my mom, she is so anal about the fact that, you know, it's the capital K, the small I, the accent mark, the capital M, the small I, the accent mark. And so, you know, she always, sometimes if she sees me writing it, she'll say, Kimai, why you don't write it the way it is? And I'm like, Mom, you know, we don't want to scare white folks. We don't want to scare white people. Let's just, and just certain times, you filling stuff out online, it just doesn't even allow.
Well,
to you to do all of those crazy, funky, unique things. But yeah, when I get an opportunity, I write it as is, just in homage to my mom.
Well, your mom and my mom have to get together and have coffee because I'm Anne-Marie hyphen.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm A-N-N-E hyphen, capital M. R-I-E. So that hyphen is in there. I mean, I learned about punctuation early.
And notice when I correspond with you via email, I'm very deliberate in making sure that...
Yeah. Well, people who have names like ours
are
very sensitive to that. I remember one time I was up seeing my mom and dad, and I was like at a Starbucks, and I was like, they asked for the name. I go, Anne. My mom went through the roof. I'm like, this is a stranger, Mom. They're never gonna. It's just easier because if not, I have to be like, I have to spell it out. My dad got the efficiency. My mother is mortified. So now I'm just like, my name is Anne-Marie Williams.
Right. Ordering somewhere, giving my name out. Oh, I'm Mark.
Yeah.
I'm Jeff. I'm Dave. It's just, I'm not even bothering with it. No, you're never going to get Kimai, and I'm not going to keep repeating it to you.
Yeah.
So let's just go with something simple that you got.
Well, you know, when Dr. Parker introduced you into my world, which is a gift. Thank you, Dr. Parker.
The amazing. Dr. Marla Parker.
Yes.
Absolutely.
We're starting a fan club and a cult.
Yes.
And I saw your name. I was just like, I need to know how to pronounce this because... I'm just too dumb to know how to pronounce this. And I love it.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I really love what it represents. And getting to know you, you're right. You're stepping into that. You're already in it, but you're like just adjusting it and making it just right. So
I appreciate that. Yes.
Tell me a little. So we learned about your name. Tell me about your ethnic makeup and what's going on with you ethnically or culturally.
Yeah, African-American, black, you know, blackness. You know, it's funny, you know, I don't know if your listeners know, you know, I'm in the process of writing a book, which I'm sure we will talk in later conversations. But it's really having me reflect on how I grew up.
Okay.
Because I think how one grows up really dictates who they are. And so the best way I can probably define myself is that I grew up in a family that emphasized and strategically told me that black is beautiful. Mm-hmm. And you can do whatever you want, whatever you put your mind to it. Mm-hmm. And white folk, anybody else, no different than you. I remember this amazing saying by my grandmother who said, they put their pants on one leg at a time, just like you. Mm-hmm. And from there, I always grew up with this. So you have to understand, I grew up in South LA at a time where I lived in a neighborhood that was diverse, right? There mm-hmm. were black neighbors, white neighbors, Asian neighbors, right? And so, you know, I'm in a house that emphasized black is beautiful. But then when I go step outside to play with other kids, you know, I'm playing with black, I'm playing with white, I'm playing with different kind of kids. Mm-hmm. And so I never felt like I was put in this box. It was always like, Kima is black. Yeah. And I'm repping that to the fullest. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to always be authentically me. Mm-hmm. And shit, ain't nobody better than me.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah.
And so that really encompasses, I think, how I define myself, mm-hmm. how I look at the world, right? You know, because I'm clear in the fact that when I step outside my doors, even with this notion of black is beautiful and all of these rich other cultures that exist, mm-hmm. the world sees me as a black man, and there are certain things that come with that.
Yes.
But I'm ready, always ready to deal with that, mm-hmm. and confront it head on, mm-hmm. and not be ashamed or bow down or feel like...
Or shamed.
This is who I am authentically. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if you have a problem with it, that's your problem.
Get to
and
step
I'm gonna
in.
And I'm going to correct you.
Yes.
On whatever the problem is.
The door's that way. Get to step in.
Yeah. Okay. And I don't have time for it.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. And it's so much part of, unfortunately, part of our reality right now, and dealing with it and intellectualizing it from our side of the fence. We have to be smarter, mm-hmm. because there's not a lot of intelligence out there right now. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of ignorance. And, you know, I think racism is just fear.
Absolutely.
And lack of education. I don't think anybody really chooses to be racist.
No.
I think it's just a lack of education, lack of POV, lack of point of view. So it's our job to be smarter.
Right.
To a certain extent, but not victimized.
Right.
So, yeah.
And even and to that point, I remember being a kid. I had my adenoids taken out at Children's Hospital, and I was sharing rooms with the white kid. Mm-hmm. And my family, we'll probably get into this later in the interview, my family, super supportive in anything I do, like they're there in numbers.
Good.
Right? So always present. And so my mom, you know, recalled that, you know, me and this kid was playing with our toys and just having a good old time. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, when his parents came to visit him, notice they came to visit him, they weren't present like mine's were. Mm-hmm. They came to visit him and they're like, yeah, we want him moved outside of the room. Yeah. And so again, this racism, you know, this xenophobia, all of these obias in our country, mm-hmm. are taught.
Yes.
No one's born with this shit.
No. You know,
we're taught this stuff. And so
we are taught this, definitely.
Hopefully I can do my part in disrupting it in whatever way I can.
I love that you're saying disrupting, because I'm learning that's a new phrase now. You and Dr. Parker have taught me, and a couple other people have taught me disruptive thinking. And I don't know where that buzzword came from. Is this an academic word, or is it just a word that just kind of came about?
Probably. You know, we always try to sound smart.
Right?
We make up words and stuff, and just people are like, what's that? What's the new? But yeah, probably, you know, I love to read.
Okay.
You know, shout out to mom for that and the entire family, mm-hmm. that kind of fostered that love for reading. But yeah, and so there's always just this notion of disrupting okay. things. And so really it's being critical and thinking about the world we live in much a deeper and methodical way. And so just really breaking shit apart.
So you said you grew up in South LA.
Yeah.
Where'd you go? Tell me where you went to school.
Oh, so, you know, disclaimer, I'm a private school kid.
It's okay.
From preschool all the way up to 12th grade. Yeah, I look back on it now. I'm like, why did I do that? And me and my mom have conversations about, Kimai, if you have a kid, you're definitely putting him in private school. And I say, no, mom, I'm not. Because she's like, no, I want you to feel the pain I feel. Feel the burn, right? but I'm like, no, mom, I know too much about public education and its usefulness for our communities. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I just have a different way of thinking about it. But I know at the time she did that because the public schools in my area suck. And so my mom wanted to give me a fighting chance to be amazing in this world. And so yeah. I'm very appreciative and grateful for that. So I went to a school called Calvary Christian School.
Okay.
Went there, and then I matriculated to First Church of God Christian School for middle school, and then for high school I went to South Bay Lutheran High. South Bay Lutheran High was in Inglewood. First Church of God was in Inglewood, was borderline LA Inglewood area. Mm-hmm. And then Calvary Christian was in Inglewood. So yeah, I did a lot of my schooling in the city of Inglewood, which is literally a stone's throw away from where I grew up.
Yeah, and it's huge. Inglewood is a huge city.
Absolutely.
And it has a lot of culture and history in that beautiful town. Anyway, I don't want to focus on that. I want to go back to you. So private school education, mm-hmm. which is fine. I mean, mm-hmm. I went from a public school and then I was put into private school mm-hmm. for different reasons. Okay. One was I was being bullied because I was smart. And I went to Evergreen Elementary and I was getting bullied by this girl who didn't like me because I was smart. And then I got to the point where I had to, anyway, they took me out and put me into a Redeemer Lutheran
mm-hmm. okay.
in Southgate, Southeast Lutheran, Southeast Baptist Junior High, also on the border of Southgate. And then I went to Pius 10th in Downey. Okay. So religion has been a big part of my life.
Yes.
The practice of religion has been a big part of my life. But mm-hmm. I get what you're saying. And then I went to public universities. So I get about the private school thing. I'm just sharing that because there's a quality of education that's there that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. And there's mm-hmm. also pressure, and then there's also a lot of discipline because that was probably just part of a small package that makes you great already. So you had this experiences in high school. So mm-hmm. we know you're from South Los Angeles. You educated in Inglewood. Mm-hmm. So when did you start thinking about being an educator?
Oh, so that was never on the radar.
Curious.
I actually wanted to be a pediatrician.
Okay.
I actually wanted to find the cure for asthma because I have asthma. And so that was always my thing. And looking back on it now, schooling never really fostered or cultivated that idea in me. And so that's why I'm so critical about education spaces now, particularly in the context of black folk, particularly in the context of brown folk, because they're not providing kids opportunities to really see themselves in the things that they wanted to do. You know, the only time I had those conversations about me wanting to be a pediatrician was when I was with my pediatrician, Dr. Silverstein, right?
Okay.
And he was an amazing doctor. My mom can probably recall this, right? Having asthma is just, it's a roller coaster. And my mom made sure we stayed on top of it.
Good.
And so regular routines to the doctor. And so trust me when I say I'm not that black man that's afraid of a doctor. If there's something wrong and I think I just a little minor feel, I'm calling the doctor. I'm like, yo, let's set up an appointment. Let's make this happen. I want to see what's going on.
Okay.
Right. And so I've never had this fear or love hate relationship. I love doctors. I think they're here to help us, you know, help us heal our bodies, minds, spirits, however. And so always having amazing conversations with him. Mm-hmm. And anytime he was doing something with me, he would tell me exactly what it was, to the point where I got spoiled by him, that I didn't want anybody to touch me or do anything. So mm-hmm. if I got went to ER late in the night. I was like, Mom, can we page Dr. Silverstein? Like, can we call him? I don't want anybody in this ER to touch me. They don't know what they're doing. It's mm-hmm. only Dr. Silverstein. Mm-hmm. You know, this amazing Jewish doctor mm-hmm. who just served all of my needs. And so...
And educated you and yeah. empowered you. Yeah.
And so, but I look back on that now in education. Nobody had me do a research project about asthma.
Yeah.
Nobody ever talked to me about my experiences living with mm-hmm. asthma. And so I think that's what fuels me now being a university professor and particularly housing teacher education is that I really want teachers now to think about who are kids? Mm-hmm. What are they coming to you with? They're mm-hmm. coming to you from amazing communities, mm-hmm. from amazing families. I don't give a shit if it's a one-parent yeah. home, two-parent home. They're being raised by foster parents and being raised by grandparents. Honor that.
Yes,
the
sir.
Family and the backgrounds that they come from, mm-hmm. which I think now helps foster who they are. And shows them you can do certain things. And what are you thinking about?
Yeah.
Let me help you get there.
Yeah.
Right? I think if someone would have asked me what I wanted to do, maybe, you know, I do believe teaching is my purpose and my calling. But I didn't get to that later on until actually after undergraduate school. So once I graduated Loyola Marymount, again, I went to a private university. Well, right. To see this private thread.
I went to Catholic high school. You went to Catholic university.
Well,
it's all.
See, so, there yeah. they go.
So, I'm surprised you didn't come out as an attorney. All the those folks came out as, anyway, go ahead.
Right.
I'll go back to you.
And so leaving that, I remember, you know, friends are saying, hey, I've got jobs lined up. Hey, I got jobs lined up. And I'm thinking, yeah, let me mosey on down to the career development office and kind of schedule some interviews because I see people are making traction on this. Because
yeah.
really my senior year in undergrad, I had a great relationship with the dean, with the chair of sociology department. And she allowed me to do a lot of my senior courses in my junior year. Mm-hmm. So by the time I was a senior, like I didn't really have a lot of classes to take because it was almost like... You know, she kind of cleared me earlier to do a lot of amazing things. And so
it is nice to be where
graduation hits and I'm like, all right, I got to do something. Applied for, I don't know if I can say this or not, you know, but applied to work for Coca-Cola.
And
yeah, Coca-Cola.
We have no sponsorship. Unless Coca-Cola wants to sponsor this, then
board. Eons ago. So went into Coca-Cola management, kind of was just like, okay, you know, I'm going to do this, mm-hmm. you know, company car, nice salary, you know, hey, you know, I can do this for the time being. And really account management and really just saw myself unfulfilled in that position. So while I'm doing that position, there was always this notion in the back of my head where I've always loved to help kids and I always love working with kids. I love helping people reach mm-hmm. their goals or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I was just like, hey, kind of while you're on this gig, see what you kind of need to do to get into teaching. And so that's when I started like seeing what exams I needed to take, preparing myself.
So wait, let's go back. So how, teaching, did it just, was there a moment when you were like, I need to be a teacher or a professor? Was there a moment, was there a click, a flip of the switch? Or are you just like, I'm at this job, I need to find something else to do. I like to help people. Tell me more, like, how did you become a teacher? Because this is not an easy path to
yeah.
go.
Yeah, and so I think it literally was, teaching is an interest. I think I'll be good at it. Let me try it. Let me see what I need to do. Okay. So it wasn't like this yearning, burning, like, teaching. Yeah. It was like,
let me give this a shot.
I don't think Donna, my mom, raised corporate kids. Let me see kind of what else is out here. Yeah, I think teaching might fit this. And so, boom. And so I, you know, studied for the exam, saw what I needed to do, took the test and did very well. And so there was this, I heard about this. So I did some substitute teaching for LAUSD.
Okay.
And then there was this initial, and that was during the time where they weren't really hiring in LAUSD mm-hmm. at that particular time.
Right.
And so I said, I was just trying to figure out, you know, doing the substitute teaching, that was kind of a foothold in where principals could know who you are. particularly because I was really focused on the elementary level. So black men teaching elementary, kind of cool, kind of different, you know, not too many folks doing that. And so it was just a way for me to get my face into a lot of elementary schools. But then I heard about this initiative called Teach Compton.
Okay.
And so Teach Compton, what they were doing was Compton Unified was under state receivership at that time. Mm-hmm. And so what they were looking to do, they were looking to recruit sort of this new generation of teachers that kind of wanted to shake things up in mm-hmm. education. And so I heard about the initiative, met with some folks from the initiative, and they were like, you seem like a perfect fit. And so got into that initiative, and from that initiative got placed in Kelly Elementary in Compton and began my first year of teaching second grade.
Awesome. Oh my God, all those little cuties. So listen, tell me about the first time you stood in front of a class and taught.
Ooh, wow. So, man, I cringe at this picture, right? Because, I mean, literally, it was the...
So, second graders?
Second graders.
Public speaking in front of second graders. That's a tough audience, man.
Tough audience. So, first of all, I have to get to and tell you the looks. So, first of all, as kids and parents, because, you know, parents are still bringing their kids in. You know, the parents of the girls kind of were like, whoa, who's this?
Yeah, man.
Who's this man?
Yeah.
Who's this guy? Right? He's going to be my little daughter's teacher? No, I don't think so.
Really?
Yeah, you could. And some of them probably didn't verbalize this, right? But it was just the impression. It was the body language. It was the taken aback and the you're the teacher for the year kind of that statement. Where flip side of that, my black and brown boys are now entering the classroom. Yes, doing fist bumps, like,
really?
Yes, this is my teacher. Way cool. So from their response, it was, I need to be in this space for them.
Right.
And so, but of course, you know, white shirt, tie, the whole get up.
Hold on one second. So, Kimaya and I are sitting outside in Culver City, and we're a microphone, so a lot of the sounds are muffled, but when a siren goes by, I just want to give you the scenario where we are. It's beautiful.
Yes.
It's smoky. there's ash falling in the air, but I wanted to have this a real conversational sense in a coffee shop, and this is exactly what we're doing. So.
Absolutely, and welcome to L.A. You
welcome know what to I'm Los saying? Angeles.
That's how it is.
So white tie.
Yeah, and so...
white shirt, black tie, whatever.
Yeah, slacks, you know, like... that whole notion of, you know, being the sort of quote-unquote authoritarian figure.
Wearing the teacher costume.
And I totally don't believe in that shit now.
Okay.
And so I'm talking to them. And I realized at that very moment, all summer I had spent devising these lessons and talking to these kids. In lessons, I'm talking about beaches and all of these things that me growing up as a middle class kid experienced that my kids had no knowledge of. And so I remember at that very moment as I'm starting lessons, because these kids are looking at me as I'm talking about these things that they have no knowledge of, I realized, yeah, this isn't going to work.
Okay.
I threw away every lesson because those lessons didn't reflect who my kids were.
Right.
First of all, I had to get to know who they were.
Yeah. Which is a big part of knowing your audience and public speaking.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to break it down even to a more elementary level. So what was it like getting in front of a class of second graders and speaking? Tell me about that experience.
Ooh, speaking was always easy for me.
Okay.
And that's because of the black church tradition.
I want to focus on this a little bit because we jumped right into your education and then like you picking education as a path of as a career. So let's take a step back. So mm-hmm. you're saying the church helped you become comfortable public speaking?
Oh, absolutely.
Tell me more about
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
And then so, we'll go back. We'll fast forward again.
Absolutely. And so I will say this. I grew up in a very... I cringe when I hear the word religious, because that's not how I would define my family. I would define my family as we're spiritual, mm-hmm. who happen to believe in God. And mm-hmm. so, you know, my great-grandmother and my grandparents, you know, my mom, very progressive. So it was, you know, every Sunday it was going to church. But it was also, I remember having Sunday dinners and us talking about what happened in church. Kimai, did you agree with it? Did you disagree with it?
Okay.
What did some things resonate with you? What didn't? And I remember having that conversation and being conversation as a family, and my grandparent, you know, my pawpaw would say, yeah, I don't mm-hmm. really like what the pastor said today. I don't agree with this. And my grandmother would say, well, I don't agree with this either. And so it was always discourse and dialogue about what happened in the church. Mm-hmm. So I grew up in a family where it was not this one all be all thing. It was, how do you feel about sin? How do you feel about the different issues? And so it was always engaging in conversations with my family, and not because the pastor or the preacher said it, taking it for face value. If you disagree with it, you disagree with it, mm-hmm. right? And it's okay. And it doesn't knock. So I really learned on at an early age how to have a great relationship with God. And so that public speaking, my mom was a Sunday school teacher.
Okay.
And so Saturday nights, I would always see her preparing to teach the lesson for the next day. And so, you know, with your mom being a Sunday school teacher, if no kids showed up, you were the go-to kid. So my mom would always preface me the night before, Kimai, you know, if kids don't show up and we have to review the lesson. And the lesson review was that you would actually go out to the large congregation and explain to everybody what you talked about in your individual classrooms.
Oh, okay. Well, and that's so, public speaking.
And so literally my mom would say, if nobody, even when kids showed up, my mom would say, okay, it's our Sunday to review. Who wants to review for the class? Silence, crickets. Nobody wants to volunteer. And I'm like, shit, here we go. I'm going to have to do this shit because nobody's going to volunteer. And my mother is the teacher for yeah. this damn class. So now yeah. it's Kimai, you're on. And me and my mom always had an amazing relationship. So it was like, Mom, I got you. No problem.
Yeah.
I don't really want to do this.
Yeah.
But I got you. And so it was from there, get up in front of a congregation of folks and talk about what you learned. And that's kind of was really my foray into public speaking. And so from that, then my mom had a colleague who was over this thing called the district, and she was over youth ministries for like a bunch of churches in our area. And she would always ask my mom at work, hey, do you think Kimai can do this welcome for me? Hey, do you think Kimai can do this speech for me? And of course, my mom would volunteer me, and then I'd get home, and my mom said, hey, by the way, Kimai, I volunteered you for this. Really, Mom? Like, this is our thing. Now you're exploding this to the max. So now it got to be a point where I wasn't only public speaking in my home church, but now I'm public speaking at other churches now, different events. Mm-hmm. And so that was really my foray into public speaking. And my mom was very strategic, unbeknownst to me. I learned this as I got older, but one of her things she says, Kimai, why I did that, I've always had a fear of public speaking, and I wanted to make sure that my children never had that fear.
There you go. Okay. Got it.
And so I'm like, nah, that's why you put me in all that stuff. And so now I'm very confident in it. So teaching and talking in front of those kids, it was like, that wasn't the fear. It was more of, am I doing right by these kids? So it wasn't the public speaking that was a fear, because, like, hell, I'd been doing that.
Yeah, okay.
Virtually my entire life.
Good. Well, I'm glad she did that, because public speaking and being able to present well is essential as you grow as a professional, politically, personally, whatnot. And that's why Public Words Project was birthed and created, is to make sure that people of now, whether they're youth or professionals, can be coached and get more comfortable in their skin so they can speak.
Absolutely.
With ease.
Absolutely.
So let's go. Okay, so that's good. That's what I wanted to know, because I wanted people to listen, and young students, young people listening, and people wanting to go on this path of communication and public speaking. I wanted them to hear what happened with you mm-hmm. and how you got there. So your mom was very strategic. Miss Donna was very strategic in this.
Yeah.
And thank her for that. Yeah. And now, so we're going to fast forward and we're going to talk a little bit more about your educational experience, and then we're going to wrap that up. Okay. And then, because then the next segment we're going to do, because Dr. Wilson's going to be back, folks. We're going to talk about your book and the work that you're doing in the community.
Yes.
So let's talk about your education. So you're in a second grade class. Mm-hmm. You, just to reiterate, you get this lesson plan. It doesn't connect with the students. Mm-hmm. You're like, let me get rid of this. Mm-hmm. Bam. Now what do you do to connect these students to get this education into their heads?
I hopped into a master's program. Happened to a master's in education program
okay.
at Pepperdine University. Best decision I could possibly make at the given time.
Okay.
Because what they helped me do now, you know, I'm just being very honest and transparent. Yeah. They were preparing me to go and teach white kids.
Okay.
And so we know in this country, white kids, white folks get the best. Mm-hmm. And so they were strategically preparing me to be an amazing educator, to go and teach in your Santa Monicas, to teach in your Malibus, to teach in your Manhattan beaches, your Redondo beaches, right? These communities that mostly, you know, white affluent folks are living in. And so
white affluent's a key word here, because there are a lot of socioeconomically challenged Anglos, whites, you know, mm-hmm. Cudahy
absolutely.
was full of them when I was coming up. Now Cudahy is predominantly Latino, but yeah, I can totally see what you're saying mm-hmm. in regards to that. And mm-hmm. How did you flip it? How did you flip the script? And how did you get it?
So it was like, everything I'm learning here, everything I'm doing here, you're having me think in these interdisciplinary ways. You're having me say, screw the textbook, learn who my kids are. You know, because in our methods courses, we were strategically thinking and engaging, writing our own curriculum, writing our own thing, so not relying on a textbook, but really creating ideas within the context of knowing who our kids are. I remember having amazing experiences working with kids, real kids, doing this program, and really thinking, how do I tailor make lessons to fit them? Mm-hmm. And so that richness, you know, and I went to school with some amazing folks and had some amazing professors.
School Pepperdine?
Yeah.
Okay.
Their Graduate School of Education in psychology. And so, you know, using all of that knowledge, and I'm saying, I'm going to use this to empower my black kids mm-hmm. and teach in spaces where they are. Mm-hmm. And so I completely dismantled the structure around me in my classroom. And so, you know, at the time I was teaching in the early 2000s, open court reigned supreme. And I was like, yeah, I'm not doing this. Regurgitation, verbatim mm-hmm. stuff this textbook is telling me. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, at the time my school was like, this is what you do. You teach English language arts for half the day, math the rest of the day, that's it. And I'm thinking to myself, what about science? Mm-hmm. What about visual and performing arts? What about history? These are things that I'm learning in Pepperdine, but I'm not being able to implement in my classroom. Mm-hmm. Screw that. I'm going to do that. And that's what I did.
Okay.
I literally...
Rebel teacher, I love it.
Found out who my students are,
yeah.
what I was learning, and implementing it right on the spot. So when I was writing curriculum and writing things at Pepperdine, I was like, this is going straight to my kids tomorrow. It was a conscious, deliberate choice that I made because I did not want to fail my kids. And it was important to me to try out all of these new things and new ways and things that I was learning, directly try it out in the classroom. So I said, yeah, I'm not failing my kids. They're going to get the best of me.
I applaud that. And I celebrate that in you because I can see the passion as you're talking about them now. And that's, you know, we need people like you to help build our future and sculpt our future. Mm-hmm. So kudos to you.
Thank you. Yeah, it was.
So how did you get on the math path? Or you got math and science, so.
Yeah, and so I really started to, so, you know, from teaching.
I have to tell you, I know some math professors and I know some math teachers. You are the most charismatic one I've met so far.
So
I celebrate that. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, so. Really, I think for me, it was always thinking about and reflecting about how I was failed in my own math learning, It was very procedural. I never really got an opportunity to think about numbers, engage numbers in a different way.
Okay.
And so probably, and again, when we have this whole conversation about STEM and why aren't Black and brown people in STEM? They're not in STEM enough. Well, it really hinges on this math and science teaching that we're doing. And can I be honest? It's piss poor.
Okay.
Because it's so procedural based, mm-hmm. and we're not really having kids think and engage in numbers in amazing ways. And so I really got started on that path and that trek because I was just like, teaching elementary, I was like, I want to make math exciting for kids. And how do I do that? And so just really getting involved in that process. And probably my sociology background helps me think about creating environments mm-hmm. that are conducive to math learning, you know. And so most kids, I mean, I look at it now, even my university students, they'll tell me, oh, my father's a gardener. And they kind of see it kind of in a, like a demeaning way. And I know they don't intentionally want to do that, but they kind of say it.
Kind of socialize into that, yeah.
It's just a gardener. It's nothing exciting. But I'm thinking, so yeah, when your dad goes out to measure, you know, to figure out how much it's going to cost to, you know, how much cost he's going to charge someone to service their lawn, mm-hmm. he's not thinking about square footage.
Right. There you go.
He's not engaging in area.
Right.
He's not engaging in look. So let's redefine this. Let's have you really think through what you're saying here.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so it's really just thinking about math and having folks think about it in a new, fresh and amazing way. And to be honest, I don't think people do that. And so I've just noticed throughout my, you know, so I taught elementary, and then I ended up teaching at a high school in South LA while I was in charge of devising
okay.
the math and science curriculum.
Okay.
And so I really began to think about this whole co-teaching model and putting math and science teachers in the same room, to showing them how these things intersect in this amazing world that can open up to them. So it's really just been my career has really been thinking about the social cultural context of which people engage math and science learning. It's very archaic. It's very separate. It's very procedural based. And so having kids think about the math power that lies in the game of brothers sitting around playing dominoes, sisters sitting around playing spades.
Yeah.
You know, how are we engaging kids? Because I tell people all the time now, there's an app that can do whatever we want mathematically.
Mm-hmm.
So that's done. That's mm-hmm. there. But how are we engaging in math? So how are we engaging in conversations with kids about math? The biggest things I hear people say is, I can't do math. But you had a running tab in your head about how much money you could spend in this grocery store when you went into it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You're doing math. When you can immediately tell me, I have a sister who is a deal maker, will find me deals and say, oh, Kimai, this is too much money. Don't pay for this. When we're shopping, and you know me as a guy, I'm picking up stuff like, hey, I just like it. And I'm like, Kimai. She looks at me and she says, Kimai, really, you're going to pay this for it? But she says she's horrible at math. You're doing math.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's having folks rethink how we're engaging in this notion of math. And so that's really my work that I really try to think about. How are we disrupting the way in which people think about math?
Ah, disrupting. There we go.
Again, yeah.
How we think about math, right?
Yeah, it's very flawed, and we've locked Black and brown folks out of it because we position math as this white and Asian thing,
mm-hmm.
super smart, and my folks are brilliant as well. And so how do we communicate that via math?
It's interesting because I had trouble with math in mm-hmm. elementary school and middle school. Just mm-hmm. I'm a creative. I was even back then a creative mindset, mm-hmm. and my dad's excellent with math. And mm-hmm. he just looked at me. He couldn't comprehend why I couldn't comprehend, mm-hmm. you know. And mm-hmm. he's like, it's formulaic. It works. It makes sense. It's common sense. You're a common sense mm-hmm. kid. But my magical mind was just like,
And so, but how when do we tap to, in? And how so do we tap into math using your creativity? That's the question that I had now.
But when I got to algebra, I'm like, oh, this is awesome.
Yeah.
Then I was like, totally. Algebra
great,
and geometry, I was like, woohoo, because it may, you know, so.
Yeah.
But, And I have a really good friend that I've grown up with, and she has two kids, and one, they're fraternal twins. One is excellent with math, and the other one is just like, you know, and then I guess there's a different way of teaching this math now, because I have single moms and single dads trying to get the math to, you know, to help the kids, and they're just like, what's going on?
and to this, and to a lot of credit to Common Core and a lot of different other math programs that are out there, right? To their credit, they're trying to have folks engage in this notion of thinking conceptually about math, but the problem becomes most teachers have a difficulty teaching it because they haven't been taught to think that way. And so now there's a disconnect. And then with parents now, it's like, I didn't learn it this way.
Right.
Yeah, because you probably learned it in a bad way, which is no disrespect to your education, but it was very linear. It was very one-dimensional. And so now you're now taught to think about math and think about problems in a whole different way. And you're like, I don't understand this. Why can't they go back to teaching it the way it was? But have we really made progress in teaching it the way it was?
Yeah, well, that's exactly what it's coming out of the parents' mouth. So, I get that. Because when I was up north and I was watching my close friend work with her kids, and she looked at me, I was like, I thought of you. You know, I'm like, that. And then I went and I sat with the kid and talked her through it. And then I think I even texted you that, you know, what she said and what you were doing, and she was like, you know, there's hope. This is coming from a 10-year-old. Yeah. So it's like the wisdom and it's amazing. So
how we engage it at the very early level, and so I'm very critical about elementary teachers. That's why I really love being in those spaces. Mm-hmm. You can fix it, but it's a much difficult climb, but it can be done. But it really starts at this elementary level and having kids engage in numbers and thinking in a different way, which hopefully I'm working with teachers now to really change the way that's happening.
Well, thinking a different way, that's what we're all trying to get done. You are doing a fantastic job. We're going to wrap up this first section.
There's more, Anne-Marie? Oh,
yes,
my God.
There's going to be more. You have no idea what you just agreed to, my dear friend. But we're going to, the one thing I didn't ask you that I ask everyone is I want to know what your favorite word is.
Ooh, favorite word. Humanity.
Nice.
Humanity. Nice.
Okay. And you have been part of this question that I've asked past interviewees. What is your favorite food? Because you and I now have mac and cheese everywhere we go when we're with Dr. Parker.
Yes.
But I say that not to influence your answer, but what is your favorite food?
And can I tell you something? I made lobster mac and cheese the other night.
Oh, did you?
I did.
Was it good?
It was good.
Yeah.
So, but it's got to pass the Dr. Parker test. So I didn't want to.
You text, didn't you?
I did say, I want to text this, but I can't text it to Dr. Parker because she's like the mac and cheese guru.
Yeah, she's kind of critical.
So I should have texted you, Anne-Marie, and show you the picture of it.
You can text me because I love food. So.
And so, but my favorite food, I would have to say pizza.
Okay.
Let me preface this by saying, like that Chicago deep dish pizza.
Oh,
like
you go
the
real.
Pizza pies.
Yeah.
So like the everyday little pizzas they'll do because, you know, that's all LA has, but. It's not, you know, there's this one place in Echo Park that I love. We won't do any shout out, but there's this one place in Echo Park that I love that comes close to that. Chicago deep dish pizza.
Do you like New York pizza? New York style?
I can eat it, but I really love the deep dish. Something about the deep dish. I like the pie feeling of it all. That's like, you have to eat it with a fork.
There's some nice places up in Oakland, thing. Just to let you know. So if we're up north.
We got to hit him up.
Yeah, my friend Susan took me to this one place, and I was like, I didn't eat throughout the next day. Yeah, once I was like that thick, and I was just like, damn.
Oh, yeah.
I think that piece made me lactose intolerant.
Yeah. But as I get older, that's what I was saying, as I get older, the problem is me and cheese aren't the best of friends.
That's right. That's where science and medicine comes in.
There it is. I'm like, all right, I'm about to devour this. Let me pop a Claritin in and we good.
All right. So we got your favorite word and pizza. It's your favorite food. So, Guy, you and Dr. Parker, is this like an academic thing, this cheesy thing? Is there like, is that part of like an academia?
You know, we go through so much hell that we probably are just like, let's cheese this hell away. Academia is tough. But I'm sure we'll engage in that.
We will.
Later.
So thank you for part one with Dr. Kimai Wilson. And, you know, I'm going to ask you all to stay tuned. We're going to do a couple more interviews with him, and we're going to jump deeper into a lot of the great work he's doing, the book he's writing, and whatnot. So thanks for listening to Public Words Project. Thank you, Dr. Wilson.
Oh, this was awesome.
Yay. Thank you. Bye, guys.
Bye.